This is Upstate's Medical University's HealthLink On Air, your weekly dose of information about health and medical issues affecting Central New Yorkers from the region's only academic medical center. I'm your host, Linda Cohen. On this week's show, we'll explore the prevention of school violence in a series of conversations that have emerged from the recently held Upstate Medical University's 5th annual Forensic Psychiatry Conference on the subject. We'll look at the stigma of mental illness and its role in school shootings, plus the new gun safety recommendations to prevent unintentional deaths from firearms. But first, the clinical warnings of who will become a school shooter. The school violence that has captured the headlines in recent years has caused many to study it and to try to understand the factors that lead one to become a school shooter. Well, here with me to share his findings and perspective on this very troubling question is Dr. Kevin Anschel, Associate Professor of Psychology and the Director of the Clinical Psychology Program at Syracuse University. And he's also an Adjunct Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. Welcome, Dr. Anschel. Thanks for coming in today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
So what are the factors that will move someone to become a school shooter?
Sure. I can describe what the research has suggested as the factors, and everything that I'm going to be describing today is really based upon the research. And when there are times in which I give my own opinion, I certainly will make that very clear.
Great.
But the research has identified that there really are three things that are associated with an individual, a child or an adolescent, becoming a school shooter. And those three things, likely will make intuitive sense. And the first is an interest in violence, a fascination in violence, having access to weapons, and also having exposure to media violence. And so this is things like video games, television shows.
So when you say a fascination with violence, tell me a little bit more about that.
Sure.
What does that exactly mean?
Yep. I mean, I think it goes beyond a curiosity. I mean, I think all adolescents at some point may be curious about death and may be curious about violence, but a fascination is more obsessive. This becomes more of the person's identity. This is something that, you know, they spend a lot of their time and energy around.
And how about the media violence? I mean, clearly that's been a major, you know, kind of political football, talking about the video games, the very violent movies, and whether we should have more control of those and limiting children from seeing these kinds of things. What does the research suggest?
The research suggests that, the types of things that we see as in adults, we have the cognitive capacity to be able to differentiate between reality and fantasy. Children and adolescents, on the other hand, don't have the hardware, don't have the cognitive capacity to be able to make that
distinction. So developmentally, they're not really able to make that distinction.
The majority of them are not, yes.
So that, therefore, when they see these kinds of video games or shoot 'em up movies,
yes,
what do they take away from that?
Where you and I may walk away from that and saying, well, that was a movie, that was fantasy, children and adolescents may be less capable of doing that, and they may walk away thinking that this kind of thing really happens.
And you also mentioned access to weapons. Mm-hmm. So that seems to be another correlate. I mean, something that they found in the research is a big factor.
Yes.
So if given somebody having fascination with violence and also seeing a lot of video games, if they could not get their hands on a weapon, does it mean they're less likely to become a shooter?
Yes. They're less likely to become a shooter, but it also suggest they may have more interest in obtaining the
weapons. So that they'd be driven to do so
at
any cost, so to speak.
Yes.
So let's talk about who becomes the shooter in terms of, you know, what's the profile? And I understand you don't want to profile kids, but what do we see? Is it obviously it's more often male than female?
Yes.
Tell us about what they look like.
Yes, that's true. They do tend to be much more male than female, and I think if you look at the statistics on violence in general in our society, that's true. And as I mentioned, it's the fascination with violence, it's one trait, but there are other traits that are consistent or are correlated with the school shooters. And the second one is personality traits. And, the personality traits is a sense of righteous indignation. They're superior, they have a lot of narcissistic traits, they're very ego ego-driven.
Egocentric?
Egocentric, yeah.
I guess one of the things I've always felt was that many kids that you hear about when you read about them after the fact have been somewhat disenfranchised, mm-hmm. that there may be this sense of kind of righteous indignation, but at the same time, they obviously often feel alienated and marginalized within their peer group.
Yes.
Is that what you're finding?
Yes, absolutely. And that's actually the third correlate, is they tend to be rejected by their peers and have a long history of failed relationships. And again, you may say, well, all adolescents have to go through rejection, and you're right, all adolescents do. And that's where the personality traits really make these individuals more vulnerable, to having a lot of difficulties in being able to manage their rejection.
Personality traits like?
The narcissism, the ego, egocentric, that they're superior. How dare you reject me and not want to be my girlfriend?
Yeah. How about things like anger control?
Yep. They also tend to have poor control of the anger, of their anger. But I think it's also important to point out that these the acts of school shooting are not impulsive. And so the anger that they have tend to be a brooding anger that they harbor and they have for long periods of time, as opposed to a reactive anger that they get impulsive and they act out and then later they regret it.
So basically you're saying that you just implied something I hadn't really thought about. You're saying in most cases, these school shooters, it's very premeditated. They spend
Absolutely.
A lot of time
Absolutely.
Planning the attack.
Absolutely.
And gathering the ammunition, gathering their weapons, and what are the underlying thoughts or beliefs that would generate this? You mentioned something like righteous indignation, my victims deserve it, but what else?
Yep. There tend to be two beliefs that individuals who do the school shooting. The first belief is an attempt to obtain justice, so an attempt to attain some type of justice against the peer or
the
adult.
They're the one to mete out the justice,
yes.
so to speak.
Yes, and in about half of the cases of school shooting, the victims were those who had rejected the perpetrator. And so you're able to do, essentially go back in time and be able to piece together where this was the teacher that failed him in ninth grade, and he became very upset after that rejection.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, here along with Dr. Kevin Anschel. He's a clinical psychologist, and we're talking about why kids become school shooters, or more likely, what are the characteristics of people who become school shooters?
Sure.
So peer rejection seems to be a major role.
Yep, and so obtaining justice is one of the reasons, and the other reason is to obtain status. So they believe that acts of violence will enhance their own self-esteem, that others will like them more if they have this, this type of act.
Is this part, it always makes me think of, again, when we talk about media, the impact of media, that we often idealize and almost make into, godlike figures, people like the Rambo kind of person who, mm-hmm. Comes in all covered with ammunition and equipment and, is firing out of both hands at the same time. We kind of, we make them heroes.
Sure.
Do you think that's part of what feeds that notion that somehow they will gain greater self-esteem in the community?
I think it could be a contributor to it. But again, I think it also goes beyond, because I think when you or I or other adolescents, maybe they look at that, they say, no, I don't think that's real. I think individuals who do these acts really, they're having a lot of difficulty being able to, the reality and the fantasy line is very blurred.
Right. So what, there are warning signs, though, clearly. When we talk about prevention, we have to first be able to recognize who these kids are mm-hmm. early on before, obviously, if they're spending a lot of time premeditating some kind of attack, we would like to somehow be able to recognize what the signs are.
Yeah.
What are some of those clinical warning signs?
Well, in the cases of the school shootings, the school shooters gave hints. They conveyed information to peers. They talked to others that they were going to do this.
And so there would be threats made.
There would be threats.
On sometimes social media,
yes,
perhaps?
Yes, exactly. Actually, that's usually where it is, on Facebook or other. So they threats. And so again, I want to be very clear, it isn't impulsive. And so there are some warning signs. These are not things that's a snap, hasty decision. These are things that are going on for weeks and months.
Are there other warning signs other than the fact that they're threatening?
Well, I think, I think if they're rejected, I think that's a very big one in, you know, continuing
to assess. If they're known to be rejected. It strikes me, I want to talk a little bit, I don't want to run out of time, about prevention. And obviously, one is to recognize the warning signs, but it seems that there a culture of bullying, which has been talked about so many times and so much recently in our middle schools and our high schools, are these kids often the targets of bullying as opposed to the ones who do the bullying?
No, it's actually both. They actually have some combination of both, that they're a bully but also bullied. And so individuals who were the school shooters who have done these acts have a history of both. So it's hard to say it's only the bullies that do this or the bullied, because these folks have some combination of both.
So what can we do about it? And what can be done? Do you believe that some of these bullying programs, anti-bullying programs in schools and developing a culture of compassion within our schools could really make a difference?
I think that's... at this point, you're getting my opinion.
Okay.
And so I think that is important. I think that's very important. And I think the outcome data would suggest that it is helping those individuals, or it's helping some individuals. But again, I think it's important also to look at the outcome data right now, at least, would suggest the bullying programs are helping those that we shouldn't really be worried about in the first place. And so I think we really need to look at doing maybe some different things in the bullying programs and maybe changing the context and the contents of the bullying programs.
Like what? What are you thinking to reach the more aggressive kids? What
Sure.
would you be doing?
Sure. For example, right now, a lot of the bullying programs around empathy and trying to teach individuals to have empathy.
Because it sounds to me like that's been one of the missing factors.
Yes.
If somebody goes out and takes a gun and it randomly shoots 15 people,
right.
they obviously, it's been said, they don't feel any empathy at
yes.
that moment.
Yes. And again, that sounds great on paper, and I'm sure it's working for a lot of children we shouldn't be worried about. Unfortunately, the school shooters have a cluster of personality traits in which they tend to be callous and unemotional, and they don't have a lot of empathy.
So what would you do differently? I don't want to run out of time.
Sure. Yeah. I think a lot of it really involves not necessarily just working with that individual, him or herself, but the entire context. So teachers, parents, trying to get other people involved rather than targeting that one person as the identified patients or the identified individual. And oftentimes it's rejection that kind of tips them over, and so trying to build in supportive relationships.
So the idea is that you really want to change the culture.
Change the culture of the school. Mm-hmm. And there are some schools that don't really have to change very much. They're already there. But there's also some that it's a very competitive culture.
Do you think there's enough therapy available for young adolescents these days? I mean, and I know that's a whole topic we could talk about ad nauseum, but what's your take on that?
No, my take is there is not, particularly in towns like Syracuse, in which we don't have a tremendous amount of therapists that are available.
For adolescents.
And for adolescents, for children, even for adults. There are very long waiting lists at clinics around town, and so the answer to that, I can give you a very clear no. There is not enough resources available.
And that would play a role, obviously. Earlier intervention, recognizing these kids and changing the culture is what I'm hearing from you.
That's the goal.
Very little bit of time. Is security, higher security, the answer in your
mind? I don't
mind?
Believe that that's the answer. Again, you're getting an opinion. I'm not aware of any data suggesting it is or isn't the answer.
The NRA would like us to think it's the answer.
Yeah. Well, I'm not aware of any data. I think that's probably opinion as well.
Well, I want to thank you. This has been very enlightening for me. I appreciate your coming in. I'm sure our listeners appreciate all this information. My guest has been Dr. Kevin Anschel, Associate Professor of Psychology and the Director of Clinical Psychology Program at Syracuse University. He's also an Adjunct Associate Professor of Psychiatry at Upstate Medical University. Next, school shootings and the stigma of mental illness. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. By now, you all recognize the names. Columbine, University of Texas, Virginia Tech, Sandy Hook Elementary. They were all the scenes of school shootings with tens of innocent victims randomly shot and killed. These tragedies have continuously led to calls for increased gun control. But no less crucial, what has also come under scrutiny, is the role of mental illness in these events and its stigma in our country. And here with more on this is Dr. Leonard Newman, Associate Professor of Psychology at Syracuse University. Welcome, Dr. Newman.
Thank you
for coming. So let's start with helping us understand, what do you think the role of mental illness is in these high-profile shootings?
Well, certainly in many of these high-profile shootings, the shooters have been people with serious mental health issues. That is clear. But first of all, we shouldn't assume that's the case all the time. For example, you started with Columbine. Based on my understanding of that, I don't think there are any mental health screening procedures in existence that would have screened out those two young men. We can label them mentally ill in retrospect based on what they did. But, you know, no system that is currently being contemplated or that we know about would have picked up on something there. In addition, I just want to emphasize, too, that these school shootings of the kind that you mentioned, these are high-profile cases, and for good reasons. They're horrifying, but they're certainly not representative of gun violence in general. And though there does seem to be a connection between mental illness and these kinds of high-profile shootings, the idea that gun violence and mental illness are two issues that are inextricably linked is something that I think is questionable.
Yeah, and it's really gotten to be very, very much in the public mind.
Yes, in part because one of the responses to what happened in Sandy Hook was calls for things like mental illness registries, so that, you know, we have people with mental illness on a list somewhere and that perhaps these are people who could be denied firearms. Now, I don't think anybody really knows what we're talking about here when we talk about these registries here. You know, does that mean if you once sought out treatment for depression years ago, you're going to be on a list somewhere?
It's a slippery slope, for
sure. It certainly is a slippery slope. And also, I think, you know, it just distracts from some of the main issues. The fact is that most people with serious mental illness do not engage in violent behavior. Most violent behaviors are committed by people not with mental illness. Even the violent behaviors engaged in by people with mental illness, just a very small percentage of them, involve firearms. In fact, people with mental illness are much, much more likely to be victims of violent crime than the opposite.
I think that's a really key point. So what, though, when we talk about these mass shooters, and you mentioned that at least in some cases there was mental illness involved, what's the profile of some of these young men? I say young men, that adds to the profile. What do these people look like generally?
Yeah. I'm so suspicious about making generalizations because, you know, by definition, these are rare, shocking events. You know, it's not like we have a large population to draw from. And because of that, you know, it's easy to make generalizations that might not be warranted. So, again, many of these people have had serious mental health problems, and there certainly are cases where, in retrospect, it seems like, you know, someone wasn't doing their job. Somebody really should have flagged this person for more serious help and intervention.
But we do know that in many cases, these shooters, anyway, these high-profile shooters have been male, have been young, in some cases disenfranchised. I'd say in a majority of cases, maybe the subjects of bullying, that kind of thing. And I guess the question I have, and this I'm sure most people do have, is What has been the role of some cultural things like, for example, video games, violent video games, in encouraging or promoting this kind of behavior? Mm-hmm. Whether that's mental illness or not, let's put that aside.
Sure, sure. Yeah, well, sticking with the cases we talked about, I think it probably is the case that for a lot of these young men, we will find that they were heavy users of violent video games. And one might be tempted to use that as evidence for these kinds of games having somehow encouraged these crimes. But, you know, first of all, let's remember probably a majority of young men play these kinds of games.
Right.
So it's no shocking thing to discover that they did as well. But
I think it's controversial.
It is controversial,
because there's evidence on both sides, and yet I guess there's no conclusion there. I mean, I know from reading that I've done years ago that games like Mortal Kombat, for example, which was very popular many years ago, was actually used in the military to train people to go out and kill.
Sure.
And yet it was made available to youngsters in the general population. But I guess there's been a lot of research trying to tie the two, but it's
not
conclusive.
And it's not surprising the military would use it. I mean, we know if you present people with behavior, you model behavior for them, they learn that behavior. They now have those behaviors as part of their behavioral repertoire. So, sure, you can teach people behaviors with these types of games. And, you know, as far as the evidence goes, we have hundreds and hundreds of laboratory studies, controlled experiments, that show pretty conclusively that exposure to these kinds of games does affect people's behavior, does make aggressive behavior more likely.
In the short run, anyway.
In the short term, right. So the laboratory evidence, as you're suggesting, doesn't really settle the argument, because obviously, people would like to know, do we have evidence for longer-term effects? Do we have evidence that these games affect people outside of the laboratory? And those kinds of data are always messy and will always be controversial.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, here along with Dr. Leonard Newman, and we're talking about school shootings and mental illness. So why do you think mental illness and the stigma attached to it has become kind of the focus for all of the energy around trying to control these school shootings?
Well, for a couple of reasons. One, because as we discussed, many of the high-profile cases, the cases that people remember that attracted the most attention, did involve mental illness. But more generally, it's very easy to scapegoat people with mental illness for things. Now, I'm a social psychologist, and we study prejudice and discrimination, and there are lots of ways of studying that. One way is to just ask people what their attitudes and beliefs are. Now, there are other ways to study it, but sometimes people will tell you what they think and share their negative attitudes with you. So years ago, we studied anti-Semitism. Well, it's not so easy to find people anymore who are comfortable saying nasty things about Jewish people. Then we looked at anti-black prejudice. There clearly is plenty of anti-black prejudice, but a lot of people are going to be hesitant to share those beliefs with you. Homophobia, that's something else we studied. Anyway, what I'm getting at is that today, among the few groups that people seem quite comfortable saying nasty, pejorative things about are people with mental illness.
So it remains, really, there remains a high level of prejudice against people with mental illness, is what you're saying.
Yes, absolutely.
And it's evident. I mean, it's
evident
up front.
From research done on the topic, and it's evident in everyday life. Just a few months ago, the New York Post ran an editorial on some controversy around closing group homes for people with mental illness. The title of the editorial was, "Here Come the Crazies." Now, it's hard to imagine an editorial about any other group of people or society with, you know, pick your nasty term for that group.
That's shocking, actually. It really is.
It's out there.
That also leads me to wonder if that may not be an underlying reason why funding for mental health services is on the decline as well. What's your thought about that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, that's certainly does play a role in this, that funding has gone down.
Well, it plays a role. I guess what I'm saying is it's both two sides of the same coin. Mm-hmm. It may play a role in why we have more mental illness evident in our in our, you know, common world, but it also may be the reason people are not willing to fund services for those.
And also, I think, unfortunately, the prominence of these high-profile cases maybe gives people the impression that, well, these interventions don't work anyway, so what's the point of throwing money at them, when in fact that is very much not the case, but I think there might be that kind of a perception.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, because I remember this most recent, the Newtown, that Adam Lanza was clearly having problems. He was identified as having problems, but I wonder whether he got any help at all, and whether the stigma attached to getting help stood in the way.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and the stigma does get in the way. I was just hearing yesterday about how in the military, for example, in particular, if there is a mental health crisis, probably one of the most important issues is the fear that members of the armed forces have that if they seek out help for some of these issues, that it will damage their careers because of the stigma attached to it. And there is plenty of research indicating that a perception that some condition is stigmatized will inhibit people from seeking help.
That's probably true in many professions when you think about it. Mm-hmm. It's probably true in the medical profession, for example, or perhaps even in the business profession, you know, in the world of business. If people think that you're you're a banker and you want to be loaning money and you've had any indication that you've had some instability, so-called.
Yes. Oh, yeah, absolutely. Now, of course, this raises the issue, what are we doing about the stigma? And there are, in fact, many groups conducting campaigns trying to undermine the stigmatization of people with mental illness.
What are they doing? I don't want to run out of time, so see if you can quickly tell us.
Very quickly, well, some of my recent research shows that some of the campaigns waged, they're done with the best intentions, and it seems like they should be effective, but in some cases might actually backfire. Now, if I could tell you what we should do instead, I might not be sitting here. I'd be somewhere administering my large federal grant
get
this anti-stigma program off the ground.
Right.
But just briefly, a lot of these current campaigns emphasize that mental illnesses are diseases. They're uncontrollable. They can strike everyone. But it's understandable why you might emphasize that, but it's possible that those messages, rather than generating sympathy, scare people, and that's not really what you want to do.
Well, it sounds like a very, very, very large problem for our society, and it hopefully people like yourself and others who are working to try to eliminate the stigma might get somewhere. I can only hope. But I thank you so much for coming in and sharing your perspective on this. It's a very, very crucial topic. My guest has been Dr. Leonard Newman. He's Associate Professor of Psychology at Syracuse University. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Hi, I'm psychologist Dr. Rich O'Neill with this week's Checkup from the Neck Up. Well, folks, a while back, I watched the news about the first painful funerals from the Sandy Hook massacre. Pictured were two kids buried that day. A beaming boy and a glowing girl, both 6 years old. The newscaster said the little guy had been shot 11 times. Since that time, we've been arguing over how to reach our common goals to feel safer and protect ourselves and our children against gun violence. As a psychologist, I know our most basic human instinct is to keep ourselves and our loved ones alive. When I think of someone harming my loved ones, I can easily imagine using a gun for protection. But that fear-reducing, reassuring thought is really a hypothesis that a gun would protect us. What are the scientific data? Researchers in this area have shown that the mere presence of a gun in an emotionally volatile situation makes aggressive action significantly more likely. And national law enforcement statistics show people who have a gun are much more likely to be murdered with it than to protect themselves, something like 20 to 30 times more likely. And people using a gun are much more likely to succeed in killing themselves than with some other method, again, something like 20 times more likely. So while the expression goes, guns don't kill people, people do, the research data show it's actually guns and people kill people. And we can't reassure ourselves that only the mentally ill kill people, because only a very small percentage of murders are committed by the mentally ill, estimated at less than 5%. A good friend's 15-year-old, well-liked, smart, football-loving son fatally shot himself in the heart because his girlfriend broke up with him. If that gun hadn't been there, he probably would have just moped around a few weeks. You remember doing that after your first breakup? Me too. We didn't have guns in our house. Yes, the trigger pulls the finger of the emotionally upset person, but not necessarily the mentally ill person. And we all get emotionally upset at times. People say there's no simple solution to this problem. That's true. Did you know that there was an armed guard in Columbine during that massacre? And I was surprised to realize that of the three people the Boston Marathon bombers encountered up close on the run, their neighbor, the man whose car they stole, and the campus policeman at MIT, the one they killed was the only one with a gun, the policeman, unfortunately. The trigger pulls the finger. But the thought no simple solution doesn't mean no solution. As a psychologist, I know getting stuck in polarized arguments about constitutional rights versus safety can keep us from our painful feelings about these realities and using those feelings to motivate us to improve the situation. I know there are ways to protect our constitutional rights and keep the trigger from being pulled so often. When I saw those little kids' faces, I felt deeply sad and deeply determined to find those ways. You too? We don't have to be ruled by our fears into taking refuge in unscientific ideas. Let's join around our common goals to find realistic ways to increase gun safety and reduce our fear and keep us and our children alive. I'm psychologist Rich O'Neill. Thanks for tuning in.
Next up, how will the new recommendations for gun safety keep our children safer? And don't forget to stay with us for our visit from the Healing Muse. You're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
Dr. Donna Bakke, Chair of Public Health and Preventive Medicine at Upstate, with your Healthy Monday Minute for September 16th. Start at the store. Every year, one out of six people get sick from foodborne illness. Thankfully, you can take action at the grocery store to stay healthy. When shopping, pick up non-perishables first, followed by refrigerated or frozen items, and deli counter items last. Make sure you're purchasing food that is fresh, the sell-by date is current, and that it has been kept at the correct temperature. Place cold items together in the cart to retain coldness. Have meat and poultry bagged separately from other food items. Refrigerate all perishable items immediately after returning home. This week, try to plan your shopping ahead of time so that you can make a grocery run quick, efficient, and most importantly, safe. Have a healthy Monday and a healthy week.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. According According to national statistics, in 2002, 60 children ages 14 and under died from unintentional firearm-related injuries in this country, and more than half of those children were between the ages of 10 and 14. But the good news is that the number of unintentional deaths from firearms declined 80% from 1997 to 2002. And here to fill us in on the current status of gun safety efforts is Dr. George Starr. He's an Emeritus Clinical Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University. Thank you for coming in, Dr. Starr.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So let's begin by talking about gun safety. I mean, There are a lot of guns in this country, probably more than most people realize.
That's absolutely correct. In some parts of the country, gun ownership is as high as almost 60% out in the West and even in the South. Even in the Northeast, gun ownership, which had been as low as 25% a few years ago, is now back up to 35% and maybe approaching 40%.
So it's been growing, actually.
Yes. And I think actually some of the recent legislative attempts at gun control have actually spurred firearm purchases and ownership. And one of the interesting areas is first-time gun buyers, which include many women who are purchasing firearms for self-defense.
What's your hypothesis there? Why would that be? Why do you think the legislation is playing a role?
I think people want to be sure they can obtain firearms before it really becomes impossible to do that.
So it, going back to that whole idea of self-defense or the First Amendment rights, people...
Second Amendment rights,
I meant Second Amendment rights.
Right.
People basically want to have that freedom.
In this culture, in our country, in this culture, yes.
Right. So you're seeing it going up. It sounds like, you say it's an all-time high, actually?
That's correct. Current estimates are that there's at least one firearm for each person in the population, that so it's approaching 300 million at
wow.
least registered firearms,
and that doesn't even come close to speaking about all of the
unregistered,
illegal
unregistered firearms.
Wow. So what are the factors that you need to consider when you're thinking about gun safety? I mean, if we have guns everywhere, if they're
mm-hmm.
ubiquitous,
right,
how do we protect our children from unintentional injury?
I think we need to educate ourselves and also to educate our children about firearm safety. One of the important areas is when children are either playing with fake firearms or watching TV, to educate them about firearm safety rules and from an early age. Children, boys in particular in this culture, have a curiosity about guns and will play with them if they find them. And so keeping them locked up, if you have firearms in your home, keeping them locked up is important. Even families who do not own firearms and don't want them may have to educate themselves, because although 50% of unintentional accidents occur in the home of a firearm owner, another 30 to 40% occur in the homes of friends and relatives and neighbors. And so you may have a child who has no firearms in their home but goes to a friend or neighbor and then is exposed to a loaded firearm that they don't know.
It's interesting that you talk about the importance of locking them up. I know that
yes.
As we talk in this this whole concept of preventing school violence, one of the factors that's played a role, obviously, besides children being alienated, unhappy, I mean, the people who become school shooters, is that they have access in some ways
that is correct.
To guns.
Yes.
So how do we prevent that?
By educating our adults about making sure their firearms are locked away safely from the kids, and that the ammunition is also stored separately and locked away. And one little trick is to make sure that you keep your lock keys off your home keys is stored separately. Children will find access to guns if they can.
Yeah, it's funny because I remember many, many, many years ago now, I have two little boys. They're grown men now. Even though we tried to, in a sense, dissuade them from being interested in guns and in shooting, because we don't own guns ourselves, they always ended up finding a way to make something into a gun. So boys seem to be very curious and interested in guns, as you had said.
Absolutely. And so as one way to deal with that curiosity, rather than trying to stop and block it, is to actually use it as a way to educate them about safe handling.
So how do you go about, I mean, if you have, I guess first let me ask you, what does the American Academy of Pediatrics recommend in terms of gun safety?
Their recommendation can be summed up in one simple sentence, and that is the safest home for a child is one without any firearms in it. And if life was simple, we could stop right here.
But according to your statistics, that's impossible.
Well, it's not my statistics. These are national statistics that firearm ownership is between 40 and 60%, depending on the area of the country that you live in.
So then clearly the key to all of this is education.
Yes, I believe so.
How early can you begin to educate kids? I mean, obviously also keeping guns out of the hands of young children is crucial. But then you had said, actually before we started interviewing today, that if you have a child who is mentally stable and mature and curious about firearms, tell us about that. What would you recommend?
One way when they're in the early teen years and have that interest in firearms is to take them to a range and teach them firearm safety and let them experience some of the recreational shooting sports, such as plinking at targets, or I'm involved in shotgun sports. We're shooting at moving targets. Kids with proper education are often very safe with firearms.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, along with pediatrician Dr. George Starr, and we're talking about gun safety. Getting back to this whole idea of bringing a kid to a range, do you find that in recreational settings like that, that the safety mechanisms that they learn could carry them through their lives?
Yeah, absolutely.
Tell us about some of your experiences. I know you were involved in the New York State Empire Games in this regard. Tell us about that.
I've enjoyed working with children. I'm a pediatrician, and one of the fun things for me was watching some of the young Olympic-style shooters coming up through the New York State Games, and these were highly focused, very safe youngsters who, in my experience, all went on to very good careers as they grew up. So I think for them, the focus on shooting actually help them focus a lot of things in their lives.
Right. So actually, it was a positive feature in their lives.
And it can be. And that's where this breaks down is that for many people, firearms can be a very satisfying experience, and in others, it can be for others, it can be a terrifying type of experience.
Yeah, especially if they're unprepared for what the firearm does.
Right, absolutely.
If they're uneducated. And kids often don't know the difference between fantasy and reality.
And this is one of the education points that parents need to be aware of and begin introducing into the child's life as they're either playing with firearm toys or watching videos. One other piece that I wanted to mention is that non-powder firearms, such as BB guns and pellet guns and
paintball guns
also can cause serious damage and eye injuries, and they're actually responsible for more injuries than powder firearms.
So that they need, once again, going back to that notion
basic
of training.
Basic firearm safety, yep.
So where does one get that, apart from going to a recreational shooting range? How does a parent, for example, who may not have a firearm themselves but has a kid who shows interest in BB guns or paintball guns of that nature, how do they get the access to training?
One way would be to go to a local shooting club where there are always people who are happy to share their experience and their safety recommendations. Another is a website that I used in my talk, and it's safekids.org, and it's sponsored by Children's National Medical Center in Washington, D.C., and it has an excellent page on firearm safety.
That's great.
About distinguishing between fantasy and reality.
That's crucial. Yeah. We'll put a link to that on our website.
That would be great.
HealthLinkOnAir.org, that's one word.
Okay.
Now, you also mentioned that people who are firearm owning families, they need to also prepare their kids not only for this paintball and BB guns, but if they were to go to someone else's home,
that's correct,
where a firearm just might be out. So again, how do they get this kind
helping
of
information? Them, well, that can be difficult for those parents, but the information is certainly out there. There are a lot of safety sites. The Shooting Sports Foundation has a website, Child Safe. And there's information there, but it's basically teaching children that to treat every firearm, whether they believe it's real or fake, as if it's potentially loaded, and to notify an adult if they find one, and to walk away from it.
See, I think that's a crucial point.
Absolutely.
So there are certain safety behaviors that you want to instill in children.
Absolutely.
If they see a firearm, they have no
Don't
experience
touch,
with
stop,
it.
Stop, walk away, notify an adult. Yep, four step.
Right. Oh, that's a four step process.
Yep.
What do you think the role of the manufacturer is here? Or are the manufacturers playing a more active role in terms of gun safety?
They apparently are playing a more active role in firearm safety. Some firearms are now coming with internal locks where a key is needed to actually activate the firearm. Others, most firearms being sold today actually also come with some kind of safety lock that can be attached externally to the gun to make it inoperable. So there's a lot of push for that kind of safety stuff.
It would seem to me that they could play a very significant role.
They do, and they are
at
this point in time now. And
yeah.
I think that hopefully is part of the reason that we're seeing a decline in unintentional accidental firearm injuries.
And also, although it's a small, very small percentage of kids who become school shooters, when we talk about kids in general, the fact that we can keep guns out of the hands of kids in general still has to have that positive effect.
Even in firearms-owning families, keeping the firearms locked and ammunition separate and locked is important for all of this, yeah.
So I think there's some good news here, though, because the new statistics suggest that there is a decline. Tell us about that.
I'm just looking at CDC numbers, and they show a decline in accidental injuries, accidental deaths, and that's all very good news.
And as you as a pediatrician really had, in your very august career, had not seen that many direct injuries.
No firearm injuries. I did have one child who had a BB in the eye. Unfortunately, was able to retain some sight. But again, so my experience there is limited, at least with the practice I have.
Has been positive in a
it
sense.
It has been positive.
So
yeah.
With the right education and training, as you said, and with the numbers seemingly on the decline, that perhaps this message is getting out.
I believe it is and should and needs to continue. Yeah.
Needs to continue. Well, I want to thank you so much for coming in, sharing all this very important information with us. My guest has been Dr. George Starr. He's an emeritus associate professor of pediatrics at Upstate Medical University and a firearm enthusiast of sorts, or a recreational gun.
Firearm user. Yeah.
Right. Well, thanks again for coming in. Appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you for having me.
I'm Linda Cohen, and you're listening to Upstate's HealthLink on Air.
This is Deirdre Nealon, editor of The Healing Muse, with this week's selections. When we talk about violence, we, of course, usually focus on the victims of that violence. I have two poems today I'd like to read to you, written by people who talk about the ripple effect violence has on others in the home. The first one comes from Volume 7 of The Healing Muse. It's by Daniel Corey, who works as a family crisis therapist in Atlanta, Georgia. His poem is called Sleeping and Waking, and it begins with an epigraph from the artist Andy Goldsworthy. I am the next layer on those things that have happened already. My mother bragged that she would stab my father some night in his sleep. Who was this southern girl who finally drank herself into my mother? Before he entered guest room sleep, my father slid a magazine inside his shirt to shield his heart from sudden steel and from my mother. Arms tightening in drowsiness, my father dodged a kitchen knife his dreams could feel. His waking arms crisscrossed to block my mother. To tame his dreaming arms, my father cut tops and bottoms from Quaker oatmeal cardboard tubes. Fighting off my mother, he wore those sleeves. That way, my father rode through the scenes of sleep with elbows held, locked in the cereal cylinders my mother emptied, making breakfasts for my brother and me on mornings when the kitchen smelled of bacon frying. In the bedroom, my father buttoned his colonel's jacket, by its lapel, the silver star. Some other day, my mother left. We seldom spoke of her to one another. Wrong and right seemed dreams each like the other. Time bled my past, reddening like a future. I would stitch each year, slow suture after suture. And then from volume 10, I have Monica Birchfield's poem, Vows. My parents only touched when they fought. At night and outside, their shadows spilling the lawn like cloth across a loom. The four of us from the windows were embarrassed, but pleased as their dark rib cages wove into one another until they finally merged, their many arms like a Hindu god dancing in our front yard. So when my brother calls, asking if I believe in marriage, I remind him how the fights would end. My mother's cheeks yellow in the porch light, the moths that gathered there whirring too close to her lips, and my father leading her back inside with the promise he'd return with shrimp lo mein. Later, the scrape and clink of spoons against ice cream dishes as we listened from our beds, like wedding guests, tired from traveling, ready for the couple to lean in and kiss.
Thank you for joining us for Upstate's HealthLink on Air, brought to you each week by Upstate Medical University in Syracuse, New York. Please join us again next week when we visit with clergy who are learning how to assist in the healing process. And we'll meet Upstate's new Dean of Nursing. I'm Linda Cohen. Thanks for listening.